Oh my goodness, I am kind of frustrated. I just had a great interview, and I'm going to put it up, but my mic was not my mic, and her mic was fantastic. So kudos to her pops who helped her set all this up. My interview with a young lady who recently attended something, and I say it all at the start, so it doesn't matter. I didn't say it now. I'm just here now to tell you I'm sorry. My sound's terrible, but hers is great, and it's a good conversation. So please enjoy, and think twice, and think hard, and remember that Pantene is made up of toxic chemicals for the most part.
So if you've been watching the YouTube, you notice that over the weekend I mentioned and got a whole lot of questions about the National Youth Gathering of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And while it's not really my favorite thing to do a lot of in-school or in-house political stuff, I care about the Missouri Synod, but I don't care enough to think that our problems or our debates are the mission of the church. And so I normally don't try to dig into this too much, but I was kind of surprised how much random commentary I was getting via the contact page on this. So I talked about it a little bit. And I had a number of people reach out to me and say, hey, I was there, or hey, I know someone who was there, and it'd be cool to hear you talk to this person or talk to me about that. And one of those people is actually going to be my guest today. We're going to be talking for this hour with Emmy. And Emmy is a 17-year-old Lutheran. So we'll say, hi, Emmy. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Emmy. Hello. And you are a senior in high school.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
And you are a almost lifelong Lutheran. You mentioned you were baptized at age 4.
Yes, I was. I still went to church before then, so I obviously don't remember that, but yeah.
Were you being taken to a Lutheran church before that, or did your family come into the Lutheran church? Clearly your mother had not been baptized, so there was something going on there too.
Yeah, my dad grew up Methodist, but he did go to a Lutheran school. My mom was never brought up in any sort of religion exactly. Her dad is Buddhist, and then her grandma, her mom, I have no idea. But yeah, so she never grew up Christian or any of that. But then she met my dad, and then they had me, and then he wanted to look for a church. And so they went all over the place, but they found Shepherd of the Valley. And then when my sister was born, then we decided that we would be baptized there.
Okay. So was that experience for her, did she ever share with you, was it sort of like an aha moment, or was it just like sort of a very gradual thing? She ever talked about that at all?
We've had conversations, I think, about this before. It hasn't been that deep. But I do remember that it wasn't like an aha moment. It was more of it was definitely more of a gradual thing.
Yeah, it's often the way. I'm also curious about Buddhism. So is Buddhism a topic the family ever discusses, or just kind of in the past now?
I mean, it's not necessarily in the past, nor is it really that present right now. It's, all I know is that my grandfather is Buddhist, but I don't know how seriously he actually takes it. So.
Okay. Yeah. I find Buddhism interesting because of all the world religions, it's kind of the least religious.
Yeah.
And it can have a lot of overlaps with some things that Christianity would teach about the law, that is about, you know, right and wrong. It can be very, very perceptive on those things. But then at the same time, depends on the Buddhist. You can get very pagan strains of Buddhism as well, where they're doing sacrifices and all this kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm always curious for those who maybe would come out of that and become a Christian, you know, what kind of influence they might retain, or what kind of insights they might retain. So, okay. So for yourself then, I mean, you don't remember being baptized probably, or do you?
No, I remember, you know, when I was a kid, I would, whenever I got wet at all, like I would just, shake my head around. So I splashed the pastor with my own hair, but that was about it.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And what then is your first real memory of this church that you were going to?
I think that one of my first memories was actually before I was baptized, when I was way younger. I mean, I remember there was like a little glimpse, I think, and it was just at my pastor up at the podium, and he was talking about something, and I don't remember anything that he was saying. I don't remember what the message was that he was trying to convey to us, but all I remember was he said something about Jesus, and there was a cross, and he died, and then we can live again. And that was that was about it. But like that was I think that's just stayed with me consistently. I mean, I've had plenty of doubts growing up, of course, with my faith. I mean, yeah, but that's always stuck with me. Yeah.
That's really cool. And I have a couple of those like super early memories too, that they're almost like more emotional pictures than they are, you know, a coherent line of thinking. Cause that's really all you are when you're three or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But, the fact that your memory is of the pastor preaching, I find that significant. And you mentioned, you said the word podium. Does that mean you were in like a Bible study room, or do you think this was in the church?
No, this was definitely at the church. I mean, yeah, it was at the, I don't even remember what it's called. I went to confirmation class. I forgot this. Yeah.
Sure. So there's like two pieces of furniture in the front of the church, and usually, right?
Yeah,
you got one that looks like a podium, and that one is the lectern, and you got one that looks like a big thing, and that's the pulpit. And
yes.
Normally you would preach from the pulpit. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but I'm curious for the memory, right? So as I'm trying to piece together, what is this like deep heart first experience of Christianity for you as a child that it would be tied to two things, to preaching and to liturgical furniture? I find that interesting. In fact, when I would argue for the value of liturgy, it's usually this kind of thing, that it strikes us in a certain way. A man standing behind this big wooden thing looks different. Well, what's going on there, right? That's not like what I saw all week. So that kind of thing. So then growing up, you know, and being in the church as you grew up, was that a similar kind of experience? Did the preaching ever become something that was, you know, a little more than just, hey, it's there, it's happening? But, you know, when did you really take on a mental grasp of your faith, or a care for maturity in the faith? If that's happened at all, I'm assuming it has, but
yeah.
You know, what was your experience of that?
Yeah. So unlike my dad, I didn't go to a K-8 Lutheran school. I actually went to a Catholic school, and I think that was definitely, and I did this for 9 years, kindergarten through eighth grade, and I stayed there. And it was really interesting because every single week we would go to mass and there would be a communion thing and everything, but they wouldn't, but if you, or, you know, your family, came in and told, you know, your teacher or somebody that, that you were, you identified as in a different religion, or you weren't comfortable with, you know, doing the communion thing, then the teachers would tell us, you know, what to do when we stood up to go. Like, I would just, for me, it was, I would stand up with the rest of my class and I would walk up there, but then I would put my hands over my heart like a little cross, and then they would just bless me. But I think that kind of experience growing up, just, you know, me feeling like really out of place, not only because, you know, I was a Lutheran in a Catholic school and some kids weren't even religious, but also, you know, just being who I was a very introverted, shy person, still am. And, I was not really comfortable with like, telling people what my personal opinions or thoughts were about certain things. So, it definitely took a lot of growing up and maturing to do. Yeah.
So I just, this is kind of an aside. Has that changed? I mean, are you more outspoken now about your faith, or is it still something you're working on?
I mean, when the conversation, the topic comes up in a conversation, I am more than willing to talk about my faith, because, I mean, I go to a public school now, which is very different from the very private and conservative area that that I grew up in. And so people have lots of questions. And because I've been exposed to them, I've learned how to deal with them, how to answer them. And I'm just lucky to have the dad that I have who I can just come to and ask whatever questions that other people may ask me, and then get an answer so I know how to say it. So
on that, it's a kind of a shown scientific fact that the impact a father has on his children's faith is undeniable. And mothers can have an influence too, but it is just not as natural. Like, it can happen. An active mother in the faith can impart the faith.
Right.
But fathers do it almost without meaning to, if they're also faithful and active themselves. And so, do you mind talking a little bit more about that? I mean, how much has watching your father, or how, in what ways, has watching or hearing or talking to your father led you to even think, hey, I'm going to ask my dad about this thing the kids are talking about?
Right. Well, I mean, growing up, you know, the pastor, is you know, obviously a man. And then my dad, he's always been super involved in our church. He actually just got elected for the Missouri Synod for Concordia Portland. And so, you know, he's really involved with the church. He's really involved with, you know, that kind of community. And he's especially just grounded, just like not only morally, but in his faith. And he's just so strongly devoted to that. And I think it's just something that I've admired from afar for a really long time. And you know, my dad, you know, he can kind of be a little intense, you know, when he wants, you know, me to understand something. But it really shows that, like, because he's so so grounded in his faith, and he's just even though he, like me, isn't really that outspoken, he's kind of introverted as well. He gets really excited and very passionate about talking about these things. So I often like to just ask questions just so I can kind of feel the energy from him. It's just really inspiring for me, honestly.
Sure, sure. And there is definitely something to be said for intensity and passion in the faith. It's not that it's everything. You can be intensely wrong, right?
Right.
But if you really believe this to be the ultimate truth, it should maybe just touch on your emotions a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So okay, well, let's run that back through confirmation a little bit here. Because you kind of made an offhanded comment about, you know, you learned this in confirmation and then you don't remember.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like call you out.
Yeah.
I actually think that is the common experience of most Missouri Synod Lutherans for most, you know, like 97% of what they are taught in confirmation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that goes back. I mean, I'm 41 and I can say that about me in the, you know, early 90s. I don't know, you know, for my grandma, if I can speak for her exactly. But this is a challenge. So if you, and I don't want you to call out your pastor directly either. I'm sure your pastor is a very good pastor. Talk about just your confirmation experience and what you do remember that's good. And then maybe if you feel like you didn't pick up things, why do you think that might be? What do you think didn't happen to make certain things stick?
Okay, so my church has this little kind of preschool. And so it's kind of just this building that's right next to the church itself. And so we just have a bunch of classrooms in there. And so when that was literally like my second school. Every Sunday I would go to Sunday school and I would go there to learn about Noah and the Ark and Moses going on top of the mountain and then Jesus dying on the cross to forgive our sins and then going up into the clouds and, you know, all that stuff. And, but I was definitely actually really excited to get into confirmation classes because, first of all, that meant, oh, hey, I'm going to go get communion. So now I mean, when I was younger, that felt more like, oh, wow, now I'm a real Lutheran. I mean, obviously that's not quite right, but that definitely gave me that sense of kind of empowerment getting that. And it was also really cool because, like, the pastor, he was mostly in charge of that stuff, and he was our instructor on that. And he was really open to a lot of questions that we had. And so it wasn't just and so it was just really cool. You know, I was in like seventh grade when I started it. And it was just really cool that we were going outside of Noah and the Ark and all those little stories that you grow up hearing like nonstop over and over again. And now it's actually applying it to life, to our lives as Christians, to our lives as just people and growing up, you know, as soon to be high schoolers. And so It was really cool to just dive so deeply into the Small Catechism, talk about what we believe and why we believe it, and why it's so important to uphold everything that we continue to learn about our faith.
So what we believe and why we believe it—that's something I say a lot, whether you know it or not. It's just sort of I love that phrase because what's important, right? But then the why is why it's important. So you don't really understand that it's important without the why. And that always seems to tie the pieces together. I like how you mentioned that, you know, as a young person, you knew that going to the Lord's Supper was going to do something better.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and you use the phrase real Lutheran, and you're
it was
like,
going to make
right.
it official, you know.
Yeah, but like, it is kind of right. That's kind of the thing. And it's a tough scenario. Like I don't believe that we should be communing babies. But there, sometimes I wonder if 7th, 8th grade's a little late, some people know that they're missing this thing. And they're able to say, I believe it's Jesus. And the hunger for that and the, I don't know, the conviction that it gives you, the excitement, I just think that's a wonderful thing. And you made a really good confession of faith there, yeah. as you said that. Also, the idea of moving from, and I think this is a bigger challenge too, and maybe even a problem a little bit, right up there in line with what, why doesn't confirmation always stick as much as it should, which is the movement from stories to reality. And why do you think it is? I mean, you mentioned the repetition. So it was like the same stories every year. I mean, there's a lot of stories in the Bible. It's kind of amazing that we would do them enough that you would feel like I've heard them too many times, but we kind of do, I suppose. But
yeah.
You know, well, is there anything else that would make it seem less real to you in your memory of that? As opposed to like, oh no, that's a real thing. That matters. Like, why was that not something you already had? Any thoughts on that?
Sorry, can you maybe form that question?
Yeah, it's a tough question. So yeah. So you know, you're coming out of learning about Noah and Abraham and who else? But Daniel probably, right?
Yeah.
And now you're in confirmation and now it's real because we're going to talk about today. And it's like, well why is the history of the flood not something that, as you know, children, we go through Sunday school and come out thinking this is real and it matters? Like, do you have any thoughts on why that might be? Is there something that we did in the way that we taught that left it, I don't know, more like a story, I suppose?
Well, I mean, when just I think I remember growing up, you know, the first time I heard all these stories, even, you know, the second or third times that I heard them, like, I just thought it was so cool. And me being the very underexposed, very conservative, kind of sheltered kid I was, I kind of just stuck with whatever, you know, the adults or my parents said. And so I think as you just grow up, you just start to question things. That's just the natural thing that we do. And so when you hear these stories all over again, then you're like, well, is that really true? You start second guessing everything. I think that's just a natural part of growing up and that kind of thing. So I think really the best that we can do with that is really not just to repeat those stories and then obviously underline the moral of the stories and underline the importance of these stories and why you need to hear these stories. Because a lot of kids, you know, they hear these stories, but they're like, okay, so now I know that Noah went away from this flood and God saved him. Okay, what do I do with that, you know? But it's like, well, now you can remember that, you know, God looks out for you. Now you know that even through all the bad stuff, he's still there for you. Like, that's, I feel like the messages that really can be applied more, I think the application is what's kind of missing in there and that people can maybe improve on with that.
Yeah, yeah. What I wonder is, and you know, this will be different in a lot of different places, but then again, often the same curriculum is being used. I wonder how much of those lines are being actually laid out or how much of it is something else. And so the fact that you, and I'm going to call you out a little bit on this one here.
Okay.
So you talk about, you know, the moral of the story. And in my experience, that's also what Sunday school was. So I get a story about David, right? And David is, you know, this great man of faith. And so I should want to be like David in this way, and because God will be like for me in this way, and try to be like David. And so the whole thing is like a little, it's Aesop's fables, just right. Christian style. And certainly there's morality in the Old Testament. Yeah. But there's so much more going on there in terms of the lineage of the seed of Jesus of Nazareth moving through history against mankind as God is stopping us from stopping him from saving us, because we keep trying. I mean, Abraham's like, he gets a promise, like, go to this land, and in this land you're going to have a baby from that woman, and from those things the world will be saved. And he proceeds to go to the land and then leave the land, give the same woman to another man in marriage, and then just sit there. So he does everything possible to make it not happen. And God's like, okay, fine. I'll send plagues upon it. Blah, blah, blah. We'll bring it back to the land. We'll get it done. So that movement or that trajectory of the stories is huge.
Yeah.
And then there's this other thing called typology. And I don't know if I don't remember bore you here, but to see that so many of these stories are about Jesus. And the flood is maybe a good example, because Peter does this for us in 1 Peter 3, where he talks about the flood being God's wrath against the world, and about there being eight people who are saved in this boat from God's wrath and brought through safely on the other side of the water. And then he makes this immediate turn, 1 Peter 3:21. He says, this is baptism. That now baptism does that for you. It puts you into the boat of Jesus going through the waters of death and the wrath of God and coming out alive again on the other side. And I wonder, you know, I know I didn't learn that in Sunday school.
No.
I didn't learn that till seminary, you know, and I'm like, why? Why? It seems to me that I don't know. And my story is a little different than yours. By the time I was confirmed, I was kind of ready to check out. So I'm really glad it's been a better path for you. I had to go dark for a while. But okay. So that kind of pushes back in this direction a little bit, because you did mention this, and I think it's really worth digging into if you don't mind. Well, you can punt on this if you want to, but you mentioned doubts and you mentioned questions. And I totally agree with you that it is the most normal thing in the world for a growing human being to ask why. I mean, that's just a normal thing, period.
Yep.
But then on top of that, for a believer in Christ who is also stuck with a sinful nature, as we are, to have moments in which that sinful nature gets the better of the brain. And is not the Christian you thinking the thought for the moment. And that doesn't mean it's forever. It doesn't mean you're not saved in that moment. But you're being tempted, right? You're being tempted by your flesh to not believe what God has, in theory at least, surely said. So do you mind talking about either that experience and or, if you're willing to share, you know, where those places as a 17-year-old in 2019, where do those places hit you the hardest? Like, what are the things that you're really struggling with or do have struggled with in theology or in knowledge of God?
Okay, so I've had a lot of school experiences where my faith has been brought up in a way that's just kind of made me feel belittled in that way. Like, I remember, let's see, this was either freshman or sophomore year, and there was this girl that I had been friends with for a good 3 weeks, maybe even a month. And we were really close and we had a lot in common, and we would, and like every single day we would just talk and walk around the school and just, you know, hang out together. But then there was a point where, and at this time, like I was working at the church, like at my church, I was setting up the communion for the next Sundays. And so I guess one day I kind of looked a little tired, and like she was asking how I was doing. I told her, yeah, I was kind of up a little late. And the other day I was working at my church doing some, you know, communion stuff. She was like, oh, so you go to church. Are you Christian? I said, yes. And, then we got into this whole deep discussion, but, basically, long story short, she thought that I only became friends with her and talked to her so that I could convert her make her believe what I believed. And so that experience and many experiences following that with, you know, my beliefs and with my faith, with people making up all these assumptions about myself, it definitely brought me down. It definitely made me question, not really myself and my faith, but, not really my faith, but definitely more myself. That's what I meant to say. Just like, was I doing something wrong? I knew what I believed in, but maybe I was, was I saying something wrong? I don't know. I had like a whole identity crisis, I think. Yeah.
That's really interesting to me. So, there's like so many directions I want to go.
Yeah.
So, because just the fact that her biggest concern about your Christianity was the idea that you would like use her friendship to try to convert her. It is such an accurate diagnosis of much of American Christianity. It's really a fair attack. And I don't disagree with her in a sense, right?
Yeah, not about no.
But like, that's exactly right. And so I fully get that. Whereas I think most people would expect the argument to be more in line of something to do with, say, marriage or creation or all those other.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure those have come up. But I find this one really, really interesting. And then the other thing that's interesting to me about it is another piece that I didn't learn in Sunday school. And I don't know if I teach. I definitely try to teach. I try to teach it all the time. But it's one of the hardest things for us as humans to learn. We have this inbred belief that if we do things right, it'll all work out. Like we just think right. That's always how it is. 2 + 2 always equals 4. And so I should be able to do that with everything. Right.
Right.
And Christianity comes along and instead there's the cross of Jesus Christ. And you're not just looking at it. You're kind of now on it too. Right.
Yeah.
It's like, you're in me and yeah, they're spitting on you.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah. And what can you do about it? And we call that the theology of the cross. And the first thing, you know, that it will always work if I do it right. That's an American philosophy called pragmatism that drives that. So I find it interesting that that was something you had to wrestle with as you engaged the world. You found very quickly the cross was in your face, whether you liked it or not. You care to share any more about that? This is all really interesting to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had plenty of – so I have this group of friends at my school, and this has nothing to do with the girl I said before, but like eventually I moved on from that experience and I met this really great group of friends that I'm friends with to this day. We're the type of group that's very eclectic and mixed, as in there are all sorts of different religions and all sorts of different races in there. I mean, a lot of people would expect someone like me, a young Japanese American girl, to be hanging out with other young Asian girls, but I actually hang out with a lot of different types of people, and not, I mean, of course, partly because I like being around them, but also it's just cool to, you know, experience different things with different people and get to know them more. So this group, we tend to have a lot of really in-depth conversations, and it's not something that's like forced or anything. We actually enjoy having really big conversations about some really big, you know, things that are happening in our world. Like, for example, this might be a little heavy topic, but around the time when the abortion laws were passed in the East, we were talking about whether we were pro-life or pro-choice and why. And so me being one of the only pro-lifers there, you know, I said, of course, that I did not believe in abortion. And so then when they asked me, like, you know, what I thought, you know, about like abortion universally, like, should women around the world, you know, just all be pro-life? And I just said, well, I mean, that's just such a hard question. That was just such a hard question for me to answer, because the usual answer would be, it depends on the situation. But I still strongly believe in the fact that, you know, abortion is the murder of a baby, no matter what. So I didn't know what to say, but I just said that personally for me, I would not commit abortion. I would not do that for myself. Other people, I know other people might, but I would pray and hope that they would eventually maybe turn their minds around and maybe be a little more open to other ideas, other options, depending on where they are, where they're at in their situation.
So I want to commend you for standing up at all, because it's really not easy to do, right? Especially if you're a minority in a group, which everyone likes to talk like Christians are the majority in this country, and we're not.
No.
I think there's a lot of Christians out there, and I think many of them are just quiet because they're good-natured people who want to love their neighbors, so they don't go out and yell about everything.
Absolutely.
But we do not have the loudest microphone these days.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted, I'm really glad that you said that because I was actually talking with my dad the other day, and he asked me this very interesting question, which was, is it easier for someone who is gay to come out than it is for someone who is Christian to come out? And I just thought,
yeah, I think
huh.
so.
It kind of is in a way, because yeah. Obviously I can't really speak for, you know, one side or the other, but I can say for the Christian part that yes, more people would be more accepting of somebody who has a different sexuality or gender orientation than someone who has faith in a higher being. Because I mean, if you look on the news, I've just seen so many just these like videos of like really kind of I don't really know how to say this in a nice way, insane people who are like marching the streets with like all these anti-protests, and like these are all these Christian people, and it's like, wow, these people are representing us in a way. And it's kind of sad to see that, and sad to see that now people are grouping us based on that those few people.
I'm not as familiar with that. I do know about the March for Life, and generally it's a very peaceful thing.
Yeah.
Back on the initial question of, you know, is it safer? Clearly, if you're in a family where your fathers are going to like beat you if you come out as gay, like that's not safe, right? Obviously, no matter what culture you live in, or, well, there are cultures where they put you to death. I was just down recently for a couple of days in Chicago, and I was kind of surprised. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be, but I was a little surprised that the entire area, I was in Wrigleyville, so near Wrigley Field, and then it was south of that in Lakeview. The entire area, almost every store had a rainbow flag. The street signs all had rainbow flags. Some of the crosswalks were rainbow brick. It was painted rainbow. And this is an evident political statement. It's called virtue signaling. So, you know, we're all for this thing. And like your question now makes me think, now where in the United States would you find that kind of celebration of Christianity in a public square? And you'd be decried. And so that, I think that kind of proves the point to me a little bit, that we really are, it's tough. So what you did was brave to talk with those other girls about that and to hold your ground. The challenge, and I'm gonna pick apart your language here a little bit because I wanna help you, right?
Okay.
In these kind of situations, when you fall back on the "for me personally, I believe" language, you basically are playing on their playing field.
Right.
So that most of America is playing on the playing field of there is no moral truth or no moral right. Everything is sort of a matter of opinion.
Yeah.
And so how dare you say this? You can't have your opinion except for, well, you can have your opinion, but even your opinion's wrong, but you can't challenge my opinion.
Right.
So when you do that and when you say, well, this is how I believe, it kind of gives them that ground, as opposed to, and it's hard to do this, I mean, it takes a lot of practice, but to try to fall back instead on what you know to be agreed upon moral points. So for example, and this isn't necessarily what you want to do in that situation, but you might say something like, well, do you believe that murder is wrong? Right? Can we all agree on that? Like that murder is wrong? Okay, we all say yes. Okay, what about capital punishment? So like if somebody's a mass murderer and, you know, they're caught and we send them to jail, should they be put to death? And you'd find a real mixed set of arguments on that one these days. Although I would wager if they're pro-choice, they're going to say no,
right?
that they should not be put to death. Okay, so murderers shouldn't be put to death. And you would say that should this apply universally to everyone in the world? Every country in the world should not put murderers to death? Yes. Okay. So then, if an embryo is a baby, and we can debate that later, but let's just pretend. See me, my point. Play on my ground for a minute here.
Yeah.
I believe it's a baby. So if it's a baby, and I shouldn't put murderers to death, should I allow babies to be put to death sometimes? Is that something that fits? We're going to let murderers live because it's wrong to kill them, but kill the babies.
Yeah.
And hopefully they can be like, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
You know, they can at least see your point. And then that's kind of the thing. It's like, not just to say, like, this is what I believe, but to say, here, join me in what I believe as a thought experiment for a second.
Yeah.
So you can at least see that what I believe is not crazy, right?
Right.
It has a reason. And then, you know, if you disagree, you disagree.
Right.
I want to recommend to you also, I mean, there's a movie that came out. I think you can watch it for free still. It's called Unplanned. Have you heard of that yet?
My dad and I watched it.
Okay,
we,
good.
We saw it. Yeah, that was good. Really well done.
Yeah. It's a good thing.
It was
really it's had a good impact on stuff.
It really did.
So, okay. We kind of went out down a rabbit trail with that one, but it's a good rabbit trail. Yeah. So I'm glad for it. And my listeners know that's what I do is chase rabbits. So I'm glancing back at my notes here to make sure I haven't not touched on anything else that I thought was really interesting. I want to come back to there. Communion setup. That's really cool. How old were you when you started doing communion setup? That's amazing to me.
Actually pretty, wait, I don't even know. I think like a few, let's see, months or so after my confirmation, after I had my first communion.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're trying to reboot our altar care team here a little bit. And we have some ladies who've done it for, you know, decades, and they're retired and they kind of don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
But everyone thinks that no one else will do it. Right.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I think if we just kind of ask that, maybe they will. And I really would love to see, young people, like high school kids, get involved. I don't know why guys can't do it either, honestly. Not that big. Would you believe way back? So we're going 150 years back in the Missouri Synod, only the elders of the church would have been doing the communion care. Only them. No? Isn't that crazy?
Huh.
That's how like sacred it was. Yeah. And now we have to like force people. Kind of sad. So good for you. God bless you.
Thank you.
All right. So the goal here then a little bit is to shift now into talking about youth. And we've already talked about, you know, youth and growing into maturity in the faith, being exposed to ideas, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But I want to move into youth groups / youth gathering. And what I can remember, I didn't write it down and I should have, is did you attended the National Youth Gathering recently in Minneapolis?
I did, but yes.
Did you attend one of the other youth gatherings this summer as well that went on, or is it just that one?
No, I did not. It was only Minneapolis one. Yeah.
There was someone else who reached out to me and they were, and so I may interview them too, because the compare contrast of going to like one and then the other right in a row would be interesting.
Yeah.
But, okay. So as a senior, did you go as a freshman then?
So wait, no.
Cause it's every 3 years, right?
Yeah. This is every 3 years, but I'm going to be a senior. So I just got out of junior year when I did this. So this was my first time going.
Right. I think you could have gone as a freshman, because I think it's set up that you can go, you can always go twice, and this was, but you're going to be done. Like you can't go.
Yeah. Yeah.
After the next one. So, is it something that your youth group has done regularly, or like, did they go as a group 3 years ago? Do you know?
So we only started our youth group about, let's see, how many DCE entries that we have? We've led, let's see, one this year, two. So about 3 years ago only we started it. So, I mean, we've had, you know, youth groups of like high schoolers before, and we've had, you know, our pastor kind of take care of them and stuff, but we never actually had a DCE with us and doing this kind of stuff with us. So,
So what does that look like? I mean, what would the difference in that be?
So, I mean, with the pastor, like, it, I mean, of course, it felt more like a Bible study or things like that. I mean, I honestly don't really know. I mean, I should probably ask some of the, you know, past youth members. But, so this is kind of a more kind of laid back kind of thing, because the DCEs are that we've had are women. And so we've kind of had a female leader to look up to, and you know, they've been really great, but they've always like done a lot of fun activities with us. They've taken us mini golfing, we've done movie nights, we've done board game nights. It's all sorts of fun stuff. So
can I ask, how often is this? Once a week, is it once a month?
This is about two times a month, and they're always on Fridays.
And you mentioned they're interns. Is that because they're students somewhere?
Or? Yeah, they're students at like Concordia, St. Paul, Concordia, all the Concordias. Yeah.
Right. And they have to do like an internship before they graduate. Yeah. So they come and got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So how long is it? They're there for a year usually then, or is it like 9 months?
So yeah, just a year. About a year. Yeah.
Okay. What's that like? I remember as pastors, we have to do this thing called vicarage, or sort of the same idea. It's like an internship for pastors. And a lot of places run their youth program through their vicars. And I had to do that. And I remember talking to kids about it, and they kind of didn't like it. And this was like, you know, they'd had this going on for maybe 10 years or so. And it wasn't that they didn't like the vicars. The vicars are all fine, right? It was like, man, they keep leaving. You know, like you get to know them, then they're gone. So I'm curious, you know, do you have any thoughts about that? Or is it just, it's not really been an issue for you?
I mean, no, we've honestly gotten really, really close with our interns since we started the program with them. The first one that we had was like a little bit on the older side. She was 40 something. And she was kind of the mom of the group, which was kind of fun, but also kind of like, oh, she's disciplinary. Okay, so not that much fun, but we still had fun though. It was she had a very infectious laugh, I remember, and she always had, you know, fun stories to tell, and it was just really fun getting to know her. And then like the next 2 years, including this year, we've had college students from Concordia St. Paul, and they've been wonderful. I mean, they're different, of course, but I mean, the first one she was a little more out there. She was a little bit more energetic, and I think could kind of act more on impulse, a little less than more leading with her heart than with her head. So kind of got a little messy, but I mean, it was a fun messy. And then this one is a little more reserved, but she's so sweet and just a really fun person to get to know. So I mean, overall, just this entire experience, we're sadly not going to be able to do these DC interns I think because of funding and stuff like that. But it's just been such a fun experience, and I hope that more churches are able to get these opportunities to do that.
This is a really technical question, but it's for my own head more than anything, probably.
Okay.
Just how big is the youth group at this point? And then what's, give or take, on an average month, right? What is the ratio of boys to girls?
Okay, so our entire youth group is 4 boys and 3 girls right now.
Okay.
So it's pretty small. So let's see. Me and the 2 other girls, we're going to be seniors. And then there's one other guy who's going to be senior. Then the next younger guy is a junior. Then the other two are going to be sophomores. And then that's it. So so it's pretty small, the ratio is actually a lot smaller when it comes to going to church. Like, it's only me, one of the other girls, and one of the other boys who is the brother of that girl, who come, and then the other younger guy is the pastor's son, so of course he comes. But those are the only people that I really see that go to church every Sunday. The other ones, I don't even know what happened. But
they still come to the youth group?
They come to the youth group, absolutely, yeah.
And then most of them then were confirmed with you too, right?
They were, yeah.
So it's mostly your own class that's sort of the ones that are not coming?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, basically.
So that's a pattern that I don't like, and you're not unique in this. But like, so the freshman, sophomore, okay, they're still here. And then by senior year, they're kind of gone. and it worries me. I have my theories, but I'll kind of keep them to myself for the moment. But it's just kind of a bummer. I will ask it. I mean, this is a little leaning toward the theory, because you mentioned that, and I'm saying this as somebody who I was a second or a third, really, I guess, of 3 pastors at a very large church for, you know, nearly 4 years, and my job was youth. Like, that's what I did there, and so I've been down this rabbit hole before, and I learned a few things, I think, but when you talk about how if the pastor did it, it would be more like Bible study. And now it's more like fun things and you have a lot of fun together.
Yeah.
What I wonder is, like, so how is this helping you grow in your faith?
So, okay. Well, we've had a lot of very different experiences with our interns. So the first year was definitely a little more Bible study feel. We did have plenty of times where there were some breaks in between where we just had some fun, but we always got to the point of, you know, the Jesus part. Well, we're just going to call it the Jesus part. But the second year, it was a lot more fun and fooling around than actually focusing on Christ. Then this year was kind of a bit of both. But I think the biggest problem that I had with all three of those years was that even though there may have been some like parts where Jesus was left out, the part that was left out that really bothered me was that we didn't talk enough about how to apply our faith to our own lives. Because I think that's something that's really important for every high schooler to understand, you know, going into adulthood and to college or wherever they're going to go in life. Because faith, that's really something that's lost quite easily. Because in our church, in our congregation, we just have a lot of older people, and I think one of the only middle-aged people that I really see around there. Are my parents and then like a few other young couples, but then I see just gray hair everywhere. Mm. And it's like, well, where'd the other generation go? You know, what happened? But
they're MIA. They're MIA.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it's part of it is a demographic thing. That gray hair generation's a bigger generation than my generation. There are more of them. And so there are going to be more of them, period. And then it actually inverts and goes further down to your generation. There's even fewer of you. So while the world population continues to grow for the moment, American population only is growing by immigration.
Yeah.
And instead, what we're doing is we're shrinking, and particularly in religious circles, religious communities, old religious communities. My guess is that it's not an entirely Japanese congregation. I mean,
no, am I right?
Yeah.
Very white. Very white. We stick out like sore thumbs. Oh my goodness.
Not sore thumbs in my book. You'd be, you know, crown jewels in but that culture group bought into the idea that procreation is not valuable. Back in the 60s and 70s, and it shows now. And this is just a part of it. Now, this, they had some kids, but then the other issue was that the few kids they had, somehow they, I don't know,
disappear.
Teach them? I mean, that's my question again. So where is the teaching getting dropped? Where is it getting lost? Where is the disconnect? Where's the loss in translation happening? I guess, and that's maybe a good way to bring us to, for me, the elephant or boogeyman in the room a little bit here. And I'm a little nervous about this because this can be a very contentious topic in the Missouri Synod. It's one that I have pretty strong opinions about without ever having gone, but I've watched. So there's always stuff that comes out. There's always videos. And I have never been pleased. Now, that's my opinion. I'll leave it at that at the moment. But you might have a very different opinion, and I really would like to hear it, right? So If you want to disagree with me in the remaining conversation, please do. I'm not here to tell you what to think or to win an argument. I want to learn. And so, my first thought is, you know, just talk about it. What, is it a week? It's not quite a week, right? It's like 5 days for the youth gathering?
Yeah, we got there Thursday. We left Monday.
Monday. Yeah. So on a long weekend, right? A long weekend in which you are traveling across the country. You're spending as a group a significant amount of money to be with, I think the number was it 19? Was it 22,000?
22,000, yeah.
22,000 youth. What did you get, right? What did you come home with?
I mean, I think if I could just describe this entire experience in just one word, it would have to be overwhelming, super overwhelming because for me, I personally am not a travel person, but it was also just I felt like they were just trying a little too hard to get the Jesus across. I mean, I mean, everything just felt like such a big performance. And it just, there were lots of parts where it did not feel authentic. Like, they did not, I didn't really know how to feel about it when I came back, because I was just like, wow, there was so much stuff, man. Every night, it was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, where we had these nights called mass events. And I was talking with my dad about this. We do not like the term mass events, because mass, since I went to Catholic school, you know, mass is like a little church service. This was not a church service. So, like, I wasn't sure if that was an intentional or unintentional pun, but that, I was just like, well, that's kind of misleading, because this was definitely not a church service. This was a concert. This was a performance. There was dancing, there was singing, there was all this stuff. And, like, the only point where we, like, ever really got to just sit down and consider and, like, really pray and think, you know, our thoughts was back in the hotel rooms. I mean, it was just so loud, and there was just so much stuff going on, just lots of stuff. That was pretty much what I got out of that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's really helpful for me. And I'm going to jump on the word mass here for a second, because while in your experience, this is a Catholic word, believe it or not, Lutherans weren't afraid of this word for about 200 years after the Reformation. It's in our confessions. We had no problem talking about the mass. What we meant by it was divine service. So any church service where the Lord's Supper is being offered, it's the mass. That fell out of favor when we came to the States and everything moved into English, and there was a big fear of Catholics in the United States, period, like a political fear. Yeah. And the Germans just kind of didn't want to look like Catholics. We also then use the word gottesdienst or divine service often as well. But it's there in our history and our confessions that we shouldn't be afraid of the word. So I'm with you on that. I hear mass event and I think this should be like a really good service. Yeah. And instead, you got a concert. Now, the thing is, and this is like, I've heard this statement or this argument before from those who promote and or work on the youth gathering, that the mass events are not church. They're supposed to be concerts. They're not supposed to be church. But then what I don't understand is in the videos that I've seen, people are supposed to be singing along with the bands. The bands sometimes will talk about praising God or how this is praise or try to encourage that. They will have someone stand up and do a preaching of a certain kind. Is that right? Or am I misunderstanding the videos in that?
I mean, so they definitely do a lot of moments where they kind of pause in between songs and they say, okay, let's just take a moment to, like, praise the Lord. But, like, it's not in a calming voice. They're yelling this and they're, like, trying to get us amped up. I'm like, we can't really consider these things and think about God when it's, like, all this screaming. But, okay, sure. But, no, it was – I don't know. It was very interesting. That's all I have to really say about that.
I love your. I think I'm going to title this episode "Can't Consider These Things." And that's just a great line. So much of what Lutheran worship, I don't like the word worship even for it, but the Lutheran devotional experience is supposed to be about meditation on the scriptures, considering what the scriptures say. The reason we preach is that it might be known and understood what we believe, why we believe it, like you said earlier. Mm-hmm. And what's happening, one of my main problems, not just with, you know, the mass event because it's loud. I want to talk about that too. I think that's really interesting that's what you pick up on and that was your response to it. Your introversion may have a part to play that, but I'm one too, so I'm not against introverts. But we do not like loud things usually, right? We kind of like, whoa, too much. But there is another religious movement in the United States that's been here since the 1700s called revivalism. It's not really called that anymore. It's gone through a number of different shifts and shapes, but with the guy who first started it, Charles Finney, called it revivalism. John Wesley called it Methodism. More recently, it's taken on forms like quote-unquote contemporary worship. And the main thrust of revivalism is the belief that in order for you to believe in Jesus really and truly and for sures, you have to be really, really energized. And they have to, the worship leaders have to find a way, any way possible, to make you energized. They got to do it. and they will put all of their eggs into that basket. And they, you know, to any extreme possible, as long as it can convince you that the energy in this room is God's energy and that you can lock into that somehow.
I mean, that sounds a lot like these people.
Yeah, well, it is. I don't think I'm slandering them by saying this. I don't want to impugn their motives. I think that they mean well. They think this is what God wants.
Oh yeah,
I disagree with that. But I don't want to make it sound like they're intentionally wrong.
Yeah.
But it is kind of, you know, what you describe, and then, you know, the way they would even say, you know, let's praise God now, and then they're trying to push it on you. What the word you made me think of throughout that big description, though, because it wasn't just like this is loud and amazing and yeah, let's rock, right? It was like you said, you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
Can you dig into that a little bit more? I agree. I really do. Yeah, I think that this is the American Christian problem that your friend in freshman year is the result of too. It's like, we've tried too hard with that poor girl, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like you said before, I mean, I really appreciate like all that these people have done, how they've set this all up. I mean, I totally understand that, you know, they put in so much effort. They put in so much money into all of this stuff. And like, I really appreciate what they've done. And what the production may have been better, of course, but I mean, the intent was still there. They were actually really strong in Lutheran theology. That was the thing that really got me hooked into this thing, that really got me to appreciate this, you know, regardless of all the crazy, obnoxious, overwhelming noise around me. Because the theme of this was real present God. And so each night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they would go through each part. So Friday night, they talked about real, Saturday about present, then the last one about God. And like each one, they had like a little catchphrase thing. And I was talking with my dad about this. If somebody were to go to this gathering, I would suggest that they would read a small catechism before they go to this, because the presentation, the way that they wanted to convey their message, I mean, you know, the message was still there, the intent was still there, but they could have presented it a lot clearer and a lot better, because all the performances, all this like dancing and lights and cameras and all this crazy action going on really took away from the ability to, like I said before, actually consider what they are saying, what they are trying to get across to us.
I'm gonna just be kind of a jerk for half a second and say,
oh boy,
that, well, I'm not at you, it's at them more.
Okay.
But that what they're doing has to take away from what they're saying, because they're doing it because they believe what they're saying isn't sufficient. They have to do all of this to get you excited because what they're saying is not enough by itself.
Yeah,
and
because
that's a denial. I mean, it's not like they don't believe it, but in a sense, it's a practical denial. We're saying that we don't have anything we're saying. We have to make a bunch of noise instead.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because like, they have to do this because they don't think that teenagers can like understand this stuff without any of that extra stuff, which is kind of offensive. Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. Like the first thing, I really appreciated the message that they wanted to explain, which was that Jesus is real, so you can be real, right? Jesus is real. He exists. He died on the cross for your sins, so you can be real. You can, so you don't have to worry about, you know, having to be a good Christian person. You don't have to worry about being a good Samaritan, because Jesus has already forgiven your sins and he loves you. Like, great, great message. But the way that they had like all these skits, all these weird dances, and all this weird stuff around, and they talked nonstop about, you know, social media, because, you know, that's what they think the teens are going to want to hear. And the message that I got instead was, Jesus is real. He was an imperfect, weird, like misfit kind of guy. So you can be like that. It's like, wait. wait, that's not right.
Yeah, let's feed our narcissism a little bit here. It is an odd thing. So, okay, I kind of want to chase something there too, but so if real present God, Jesus is real. Okay, so what's present?
Present was, oh my gosh, they did another skit all about, you know, social media, because like everybody was on their phones, they weren't talking to each other, da-da-da-da-da. And so there's, but then like there were all these like, you know, inspirational speakers that came out and they were like, I'm sorry, my cat just jumped on the desk.
I forgive your cat.
Okay, cat, get out of here. Okay, thank you. okay. So they talked about how there were a lot of moments where, you know, there was someone who got bullied. So they were like, oh, well, I didn't really feel God there. Was he really there? But then they came to the conclusion that, oh, he actually was there. You know, like God's always there through the good and the bad. But the problem that I had with it was that these people would like jump from like one conclusion to the next. And that I feel is something that that can kind of contributes to a lot of stereotypes that a lot of people have about Christians, which is that we are too far-fetched in what we say. Mm-hmm. Like, because like these people, I mean, almost every story was, okay, I got bullied. Like, oh, I didn't feel God around me. I felt like I was alone. I felt like I had no one to like lean on. And then all of a sudden they like have this like weird sign thing that happens. Like, oh, someone was kind to me. Oh, someone, you know, stood up for me. And then it's like, wow, God is here. And then they have a reflection that's like, wait, God was there the whole time. I feel it now. And it's like, hold on now. So God's presence depends on how you feel. Mm. That just...
Yeah, you put your finger on it there.
So, I mean, like, I mean, again, I really appreciate what they were trying to say. I understood what they were trying to get at, but I had this gut feeling that that's not what everybody else got. That's right. Not what everybody else interpreted from that. I mean, with
Do a real backflip to get to the doctrine of providence, which is sort of what the, you know, the right teaching of what they were saying. You know, God's moving all things for good. But you got to do a real backflip out of that. The emails that I received from people in their concerns often did reference this need to feel God being something that was mentioned a lot. And there's a word for that as well. It's called mysticism. And mysticism is any religion that basically says you can find God through your experiences. You find God through what you see, what you feel. However the world would like to present itself to you, that's the way to find God. That's also what paganism is, the worship of nature. They're very closely tied to each other. And it's disturbing how often mysticism gets into Christianity and into Christians. Authentic Christians get deceived by it. And it doesn't necessarily make them unbelievers, but it can certainly challenge your faith. Because in every moment where you're like, I don't know if I can feel God, right? Like, well, how would you know he's there? Yeah. Unless he's there in another way. And that's what I'm curious still if they ever got to this. But I'm going to let you keep going because I want to hear the other point. And then I'm going to try to tie it back together a little bit here. So that real is Jesus is real, so you can be real. Present is God is always there. And then God, that was the last big night. What was that one about?
Yeah. I'm going to be honest. This was probably, I mean, even though it was about God, it was like one of my least favorite nights there.
Wait, I'm going to quote you. God is my least favorite night. This is good.
that's the name of this. Okay. God was the least favorite part of this. Yep. There you go. No, it was... This was the most performance-y it got. It was, I did not like this because it got all weird because, so there was this running joke between my youth group and it was Pantene Jesus because there was a guy who was up there and he had this wig on and he, you know, had the white robe on. Ugh. He was pretending to be Jesus. And so I'm like, and then like, you know, the camera got a really good close up of him and he obviously had makeup on and he obviously, you know, had his hair done somehow. And then all my friends were like, wow, that is too good looking to be Jesus. It's Pantene Jesus. So that was our thing. But,
it's fair. It's fair.
Yeah.
It's sad, but it's
fair. Yeah. But, then it was that. And then so the whole purpose of this was ultimately in the end, if you didn't get anything out of this entire experience, get that Jesus died on the cross to forgive your sins. I'm like, this is going to be a good one. And I was wrong, because they had a whole thing, but they showed, you know, the Pantene Jesus, I guess. He made this big show of carrying his cross to the stage and like going through all this pain, all these people making fun of him. You know, they were just reenacting the whole crucifixion thing. Mm. And then they kind of, they didn't show the death, of course, but they then, instead of going just straight to the resurrection, what they did, they were carrying all these candles up to the stage, all these people, and then right down the middle of the aisle, there was a casket that everybody was holding. And I was not sure how to feel about that. It looked like a real, real casket that you would put a dead body in. And then they carried it up to the stage. And up on the stage, you know, there are all these dancers. They have this like big altar table thing with like a cross on it. And they're just dancing, doing weird twirly stuff around it. And I'm like, okay, what is going to happen? So they put the casket down on the table, and then my first thought is, oh no, they're not gonna have Pantene Jesus come out of that casket, are they? But they didn't. But Pantene Jesus all of a sudden just comes out from the corner, comes onto the stage, steps onto that table, lifts the casket, and all of a sudden he just picks up this random person who's in there and hugs him. And then I was just like, what? I'm just so good. I was like, what just happened? What do I do with this? And all these people are clapping, they're standing, they're getting emotional, people are crying, and I'm like, what? I didn't know what to do with that.
I'm trying to draw a line, and I might be able to, and maybe, you know, maybe if I was there I would have seen something else, you know, where there's a lot going on, and so maybe there's a piece that's not there. But so help me with this one. The table he stepped up on, that was this altar thing they were dancing around?
Yeah.
You said altar. I mean, it really was an altar, like a church altar?
No, it was just a big, long table.
Big, long table.
It was just a table. Like, it looked like the kind of table that was in, like, the last supper or something.
Right.
But it had a cross on it. Kinda,
I don't know. Okay, riddle me this one, Batman. I am very confused by this thing I'm going to try to say next. And it's because when I saw the flyers for this thing, Real Present God, and I've heard through the grapevine, oh no, they're really making an effort to be more Lutheran with this thing. They really are. They're doing a good job. They're trying. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll best construction that this thing, Real Present God, good. They're going to have a whole youth gathering about the Lord's Supper and the real presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound like that's what they did at all.
No.
I don't know how you as Lutherans have the phrase real presence in a title and then don't have it be about the Lord's Supper. I don't know how you have Jesus stand up on an altar and raise people from the dead and not have it be about the Lord's Supper. That's what he does in the Lord's Supper. That's what I'm like, that's my line, right? Oh, it makes sense if he's the Lord's Supper, right? But then I don't know. I'm desperately, well, I'm not any less concerned than I've been in the past. Painting Jesus, for Pete's sake, I tell you, you know, I'm with you on this. I get so frustrated. This is not new though. And this is not the youth gathering. I mock and decry the artwork of Jesus in our churches, in our Sunday school material, everywhere. He looks like a girl and he looks like a pushover and he's not anybody you would ever follow. It's just disturbing. And then the Bible doesn't describe him this way at all. They call him the man of sorrows. He's about him, there was nothing that we would desire, no beauty we would desire, stricken, smitten, and afflicted, all this stuff. And every time we do it, he's like the guy from lead singer from the Bee Gees. I don't know if you know that guy.
I know. I know what you're talking about.
Sounds ridiculous. Yeah. Or Fabio. And so I get it. And it's just like, man, every 17-year-old male in that place just decided, I'm not sure I'm a Christian anymore because Jesus is a weirdo. Yeah. I don't know how to get people to get that one. Feeling God, we talked about that. Cut them clear. I wanted to come back to thank you for all of that kind of in-depth analysis. I think that was really good. Oh, the dancing around the altar, that disturbs me. That's like mystery religion. All you do is sacrifice a bull and you're really into it. So the idea of authenticity, you mentioned, you know, performance several times, not feeling like it was authentic. I don't know if I said this earlier, but the word is canned. Are you familiar with that word?
No.
So like, you know how when you watch a McDonald's commercial, like all the people eating at McDonald's don't look like anybody you've ever seen at McDonald's.
Right.
Right. And they're all supermodels. They're all skinny and strong and dressed really nice and driving Pantene. Nice cars or whatever. Right. Right. Yep. Pantene. Right. Sure. And that's canned. Right. And so you've paid someone to do this for you. And if you go to like your standard church website, generally speaking, you're going to find canned art. So you're going to find like some pictures of smiling people who don't go to that church. Right. But they're there on the website. Right. That kind of thing. That's what canned is. It's any kind of paid media that you throw into what you're doing, but it's not really who you are at all. It's the opposite of authentic. Right. So you think about like canned food, right? I mean, how good are canned peas? Like you can't wait for some canned peas, right? They're so tasty. And so why is it, and you kind of touched on this and I've touched on this a little bit too, but why is it that we think that the way to keep young people in the church from falling away from the church is to give them canned religion? I don't know. Maybe you don't have an answer. Can you help me with that? I mean, what on earth convince us that this is gonna win you over? It clearly hasn't exactly made you happy.
Well, I mean, I understand that growing up, you want to give your kids the best possible image of whatever it is you're teaching them. You know, you want them to believe in Santa Claus. You want them to believe in all this stuff. But that kind of stuff, those are things that kind of just add to like the beauty of childhood. But the faith and Christianity and Lutheranism are very real things that shouldn't have to be, you know, messed with or, you know, Panteened or whatever, or canned to be, you know, explained to children. It should be something that people should just accept. Just as a thing, just as it is. It's, I guess, little kids, you of course want to, entertain them and get them interested and hooked onto something. And so you of course want to add a little bit of excitement, a little bit of glitter or maybe something kind of cool. But like, don't like keep them just looking at their faith with like rose-colored glasses or anything like that. Make sure that they still that they just don't take it like blind faith. Don't just take it as like, oh, this is a cool thing, I'm gonna like it because other people like it and also it just looks cool. It's a real thing that people should just it should just be accepted just as the way it is.
If what we believe is the holy, everlasting, inspired, and without error word of God, then why is that not sufficient? That continues to be my question. Why do we not believe that these words spoken plainly, communicated clearly, are sufficient? Why do we have to clean them up and make them look shiny with worldly things? And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to do the best you can. But then the question again on a different level is, so why aren't we doing the best Lutheran that we can? Why aren't we taking everything that you would find in your Lutheran church normally and doing it as good as you can? Now, the challenge is we've actually got two kinds of Lutheran churches in the Missouri Synod now, and some of them are trying to look like the youth gathering every week.
Yeah.
And so they are doing that. But I don't know. You sound like you wanted to say something. I cut you off a little bit.
That's okay. I think. Well, okay. We've kind of just grown up in this world where image and authenticity and just who you are and what you show online. That's like the big theme of our lives growing up, you know, as Gen Z or as millennials. You know, it's you want to be, I mean, I think authenticity and like identity and who you really are just really big topics that come up, but it's never really something that's never, and like there's never really a solid solution that's found to those things. I think that you know, because Lutheranism, we focus so much on being real, realistic, and authentic that you know it's the rest of the world has kind of gone to this level where it's a lot of, you know, showiness and performanciness. I mean, you see that all the time on social media. You see that all the time, just in people in general. They act one way so that they can, you know, look like a good person. They want to look good. But, you know, for us, it's not about looking good. It's just about the real thing. And the real thing is good in itself. But that's not something that I guess the rest of the world is really willing to accept, I feel, because the society we live in, it's all about, you know, image and, you know, what we look like on the outside. And sad as it is, it's better to, I feel like it's better to look good than to actually be good at this point. Mm.
See, I think it's a little the other way around, though, in this way. I think the reason they're going to want to join us is because we're not playing their game. And that the more we try to look like we're playing their game, the more they're going to say, yeah, Pantene Jesus, he ain't for me.
Yeah.
But if we look like who we really are, is we're believing what we believe, we're practicing what we believe because we believe it and we understand why. So we're not, you know, we're not dancing in some kind of joke festival.
Right.
We're instead considering carefully what our Lord has said about himself and his real presence. How when I'm out there in the world and I'm having my doubt and the dark sky is over me and no one's been nice to me today, my baptism is still with me. And that is God's presence with me at all times and places to declare me one who arises from the dead. I'm an immortal in that moment. You're telling me that's not a message? People are going to be like, well, that's different. I've never heard that before. Tell me about this immortality thing again. I mean, it's just we're so far off the page. They don't even know what to make of us if we actually
knew
our stuff, right? But we don't. Yeah. We're too busy playing their game. And that is what continues to worry me. And I think that's, for my money, that's why you're watching your friends just slowly drift, because they're realizing, yeah, hey, this game at church, and not necessarily your congregation per se, but the game American Christianity is playing is the world's game, and the world's better at it. Like, if it's just about me having a good time, I mean, I don't have to come to church to have a good time. I can do that anywhere, and that kind of thing. So let me throw one more thing up here at you, and then I got a couple of kind of silly, different direction questions to take us somewhere else for just, you know, a few minutes to close. But right. I every year take my youth group to a different youth gathering, and there are three of them, sometimes four, that happen every summer with an organization called Higher Things. And what I love about Higher Things is that they get a bunch of youth together, and then you break out to sessions with all the pastors who came, and the pastors teach. And some are good, some are kind of okay, right? Nothing's really bad, I suppose. But, you know, they're different varieties of like, that was a good one. So that's all week long. And then you have a couple of big sessions with another pastor who will teach. And then you worship. You go to church four times a day. And by the end of it, you're so thankful you do, because it is fully and authentically Lutheran. It is contemplative. It is serious. It is joyful. I cried twice. And that's not, I'm not crying every week in church, you know, but it is potent stuff. And you come away from this thing not just thankful to be a Lutheran, you're just glad to be a Christian. And so I want to not only encourage you to you know, maybe say, hey, Dad, for my senior year, you know, senior summer, I want to go. But I'll even do you one better. If your youth group doesn't want to go, my youth group will be going, and you are welcome to join us. You can come out. You can be with our chaperones, with our girls, We took seven girls this year. Hopefully we'll get a guy to go next year. One was going to go, and then the other two guys who were freshmen couldn't go, and so he dropped out and his older sister went instead. But you're welcome to join our group and tag along with us, because you won't regret it. You absolutely will not regret it. It will strengthen your faith. So you're welcome. And you know, your dad has my number, so to speak.
My dad actually introduced me to higher things. So,
okay.
I'm definitely going to look at that for sure.
Yeah. It's good. They have retreats, throughout the year too. They're like little weekend things, and those are okay. I mean, they're good. They're not the same though. I've spoken at them. I've hosted one, you know, they're not the same as the big event. It is just, oh man, I was so glad I went. It was just so fulfilling. So I have a list of like these kind of supposedly rapid fire questions that I'll ask a lot of my guests, and they aren't intended to have long answers. They're just kind of be off the top of your head, because I find people interesting. So don't think too hard about it, right? So the first one is how do you measure success at the end of your day, right? If you get to the end of your day, how do you know today was a good day? For you, what does that mean?
Okay, for me, success – oh my goodness – okay. You told me not to think too hard about this. I'm already doing that.
Off the top of your head.
Okay. It usually depends. Okay. I'm not going to say it depends on my mood, because my mood changes a lot, but it's usually how much I've gotten done in the day, because I often have a lot of things to do. I have chores to do. I'm working on my college, my art college portfolio, and I'm doing college essays and all this stuff. I keep like a checklist of all the things that I have to do or the things that I plan to do. And then like, when I look back at the end of the day, like, okay, what did I do? You know? But then I also keep a little separate checklist where I just keep it blank. And then throughout the day, I'll add on to like what I did during that day that maybe wasn't on my other list, and just like, oh, I did a little extra thing, or I spent time with like this person, or I spent time with my sister or with my mom, or I went grocery shopping with her. Some just like a small little thing that that I went out of the way during the day, out of my schedule to do, that was a good thing. And so the more that I feel like the more that that checklist is filled up, more than the other checklist of all the other things I have to do, I think that really shows how successful I was.
Yeah, that's a cool answer. Has your dad shared with you Everbook yet? Has he ever talked to you about Everbook?
No.
You should ask your dad. He should know. He should know by now about Everbook. It's a little tool that another pastor created, and then he and I have been promoting it. It helps take your little list making to a whole new level. It's just like a little magical thing. So ask him about it, and if he doesn't know, I can share it with him later. But it's worth checking out. It'll take your game to a post-college level in terms of management of time. It's a really cool thing. So next question. I'm going down a couple. What book do you read? You're a reader, right?
Yes, I am a reader.
What book have you reread the most, and you can't say the Bible? Sorry.
Dang it. let's see. I think the one book that I've reread the most is this one by John Green. He wrote The Fault in Our Stars, that really sad cancer story. And it's this one that he wrote that I think is probably his most personal. And it's called Turtles All the Way Down. And I was obviously drawn to this because of the title, because I was like, okay, what the heck does this mean? And so I looked up the story behind it. I'm like, okay, what is Turtles All the Way Down? What is this saying? And so I looked it up, and it was so there was this professor guy, and this was like way back when they were just learning about the solar system. And he was teaching this class about, you know, that the Earth was a round sphere that spun around the sun. And this woman, she stood up in the back and she said, hey, that's not right. The Earth is not a sphere. And he's like, okay, well then what is it? And she said, it's actually a flat piece of land, and it's a sea, and like this flat little blanket thing on top of a turtle shell. And he was like, uh-huh. Okay, so what's that turtle on top of? And she goes, another turtle. And he's like, okay. So then so then what's that? And she's like, oh, it's turtles all the way down. And I'm like, oh, okay. So then I'm thinking, okay, what is this book going to be? What's going to happen in here? So it hit me quite with a different feeling than that story. It was this 16-year-old girl. And I was at the time I was reading this, I was her age. I was 16. And this girl, she has obsessive compulsive disorder, which John Green himself has in real life. And as I kept reading it, they eventually got to the Turtles All the Way Down story. And it was at a pivotal point in her life, her journey with her mental health, that she realized, like, it doesn't have to always be this way. It doesn't have to be turtles all the way down. I don't have to just be stuck in this cycle where I'm obsessively, like, freaking out over these things. You know, I can just be free to be me. And that just hit me so hard, because I personally deal with some mental health issues as well. I have depression and I have anxiety. And so that was around the time, I think a year after I had my first diagnosis. And so that just really hit me. And almost every single year, I always go back to that, like at least twice or three times a year, maybe even twice or three times a month if I'm feeling like it. And I just read back to that part and it just hits me every time. And I think, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. Because like feelings are temporary. I'm not going to be sad and upset or like freaking out and having a panic attack forever. Like, it eventually stops and I'll eventually get to a point where I'm going to be happy again. And, you know, I'm not always going to be happy, but that's just life. And I was just like, yeah, so that's why I think that's my favorite book. Yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's very deep. And the reality of hurt, I've battled depression for a good portion of my life as well. And I think a lot of people do, you know, it's a spectrum. Yeah. And so people are at different levels in it, but it's something people don't always talk about. And yeah, in those moments, to be able to remember that it will pass. It's a phase, yeah, like a lot of other things. The cat is back. I was going to say, that should be the name of your cat, is Turtle Down. Down. That's a great name.
Yeah.
So I will also say, and this is sort of like a long-term life stuff, that the things that have helped me most with my own depression, there's three of them. One is sleep. And oh, yeah. not daytime sleep, but good nighttime sleep when the blue light, that is your TV light or other lights of the house, are turned off about the time the sun goes down, if possible. And you get at least a good hour and a half without them. Candlelight helps. And then it helps you get into a deep sleep, which is where a lot of the restorative stuff comes. Nutrition, and we don't have to go into that too much here, but a lot of what Americans consider normal are foods that create mood swings based on their chemical reactions. And so that's something that for me personally made a huge difference when I figured that one out. And then the last one's meditation, mindfulness. It's tough to find a good mindfulness thing that won't go, you know, Hindu or Buddhist on you, but there are some out there. And I found, kind of as you were describing, you know, that moment of reprieve where you're like, it will pass. You train your resiliency to kind of step back and look at your emotions and realize, oh, my emotions aren't all of me. Like, there's more of me in here. That's interesting. So all those things have been tools I've found valuable as I've grown to deal with some of the same struggle, you know, and obsessive compulsive. I got a little of that in me too. You mentioned before we started chatting, you like Disney movies. So maybe
this one
can be a fast hit. Maybe not though. Who's your favorite Disney bad guy?
Bad guy. Oh, okay. Oh man, that's a hard one. I think I started to really like Maleficent when they came out with that live action movie with Angelina Jolie, because I really got into her character. Because before that, all I'd seen was just like all these villains, and they were just doing evil for absolutely no reason, you know.
Right.
And so now it's like, oh wow, you're actually getting to their story, like why they did it. They're more than just an evil person. They actually have feelings, you know. And it's like, wow. Eventually, you know, you feel empathy for them. You're like, wow, you went through that. I am so sorry. I wish someone was there for you to, you know, like help you with that. But like, I really like Maleficent. And I mean, if they just did that with every single villain, like, I think I would just love them all equally. So
that's really interesting. I think that's why I like Scar. I don't even thought of I like Scar because like I get him. Like I mean he's wrong, but I get him, right? And, like he's been pushed to the side. You know, he's got his chance.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of thing. Okay. So let's flip to this side here. Favorite Bible verse?
Bible verse. Oh goodness. Let's see.
Or one you like. That'd be your favorite.
I'm trying to think. I don't remember which book of the Bible this was.
That's
but,
all right. Doesn't matter. Paraphrase is good.
Yeah. but it was, you are fearfully and wonderfully made.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that one just really sticks to me personally because my sister, she has autism. My mother works with lots of kids in her situation. Some maybe slightly worse. Some have... some can't read. Some of them, you know, are partially blind or partially deaf. Some just have a lot of, you know, other mental disorders like OCD or ADHD, things like that. And it's just a constant reminder of, you know, we're all made in God's image and we were all put here on this earth for a reason. And when people make fun of them, they're just underestimating them because they're awesome who they are. So.
Yeah. Psalm 137, I think that is, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I know it's a psalm, yeah.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And you're so right about humans that we would think, oh, not like me, don't need them.
Yeah, yeah.
Are often the most amazing people ever. And our fear of this, xenophobia is the word, fear of the different, really gets in our way and keeps us from learning the gifts that God gives through others. And kind of the last one is connected. If you have it, you know, a favorite non-Bible quote or something from the Bible that you kind of quote or bring up a lot.
Lord. Oh man. I mean, there's this one that I really like. It's actually Ralph Waldo Emerson. Mm-hmm. I read him in my AP Lang class. It was, to be yourself in a society that's always trying to make you something else is the greatest achievement. Because authenticity has always been something I've struggled with. I'm sure that a lot of people have struggled with. And so just that reminder, like you can be yourself. It's okay. And then that just immediately falls back to the Jesus is real, so you can be real kind of thing.
Yeah, well, and man, even with that, it pushes me back to the theology and the youth gathering part. So, like, I don't like the way that it was described, and I can't imagine
being
happy with what I saw. But the total and sufficient grace on which we stand, the knowledge that Jesus on the cross gave all, and that in that, the darkness within me, both the intentional and the unintentional darkness, that is completely covered now so that I can stand before God unafraid of my darkness, unafraid of my wicked self and acknowledge it. I can be myself before him, sinner, evil man, and know that this is absolved by him.
Mm-hmm.
And the freedom that gives me to then turn around with that immortality I was talking about earlier and still the evil man, but no longer only evil. Look back out at this world trapped in kind of the zombie apocalypse of our sin. And say, I'm not afraid of you anymore. You can't touch me now. And I can't even touch me now. He's got me. Let's talk about this thing. Who wants to join this thing? And that freedom of conscience is a potent and powerful thing. And I'm encouraged by the conversation, Emmy. I'm encouraged by your joy in the spirit, which is very evident here. I'm encouraged by your discernment and how you were willing to question some of what you saw and to do so not in a mean-spirited way, but to really be like, hey, wait, you know, how is this what I believe? All those things are very good. You know, you do your generation, quote, I hate generation talk. You do your generation well. You show well. So if the future is like you, the future is bright. I want to thank you for being with me today. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll see.
Yeah, this was really cool.
Get you to higher things next year. We got to stay in touch about that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you.
Yep, rock on.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please?